listening to the Survival in Motion podcast. Learn, adapt, prepare, survive.
Hello, everyone. This is author Cal Wilson, and welcome to another episode of the Survival in Motion podcast. On today's episode, what I'm going to do is play a reading of part of the sequel of my EMP book. Remember, a couple summers ago, I published a book called EMP, The End of the Grid as We Know It. And pretty soon, there will be a sequel book, and the working title is just EMP 2. And I've toyed with doing this in the past. It's easier to polish and edit a book when somebody besides the author reads it out loud. So that's what I did here. I took part of chapter 7, all of chapter 8, and part of chapter 9. And I hired somebody to read it, and I've already polished a little bit of it. But what you're about to hear is pretty close to the end result. For the EMP 2 book, there are several themes that are a little bit different from the first book. Number one is the protagonist in this sequel book will be staying in town after a cataclysmic EMP attack, which I think is a huge mistake. But for his various reasons, this protagonist has decided to stay in town and see what he can do to help things out. Again, I think that's a terrible mistake. I think in a big city, which is what I'm discussing in book two here, in a big city, the EMP will be just a catalyst for other disasters. And other disasters will involve sleeper cells, you know, the terrorists, and also the criminal element, which will be in town. And they will opportunistically strike and make things pretty disastrous for the town. This reading is about 16 minutes long. And at the other end of this reading, I will have an announcement about a freebie. I have to admit, it's been a challenge in writing this book, just like it was in the first book, with not being too graphic. I think of that as like Quentin Tarantino's movies, which I think they're just too much violence over the top. There were a couple of complaints from some readers I respect about book one. One involved, you know, the zoo animals being let loose. And at one point in book one, there was a tiger that attacked a family. There's kind of another point that was a little bit too violent in book one. And let me tell you about that story. It's kind of funny, actually. I was having the audiobook read, and when the audiobook is being worked on, the reader will send me a rough draft of whatever chapter it is. And I happened to be visiting my father when this chapter came. It was chapter 14. And I can't remember the details, but we all piled in. There were some friends of the family who piled in the car, and there was an 8-year-old girl. And I had chapter 14 of the first EMP book on a thumb drive. And I said, hey, let's check out my book. And it's kind of a mistake. The character Claire in that book started stabbing somebody. And kept stabbing and kept stabbing it. And the expression in book one was overkilling. And so after a few minutes of this, I just said, you know, maybe we can listen to something else. So I turned off the rough draft of the audiobook. And my dad said, yeah, thanks. That's probably a good idea. But I don't think that part was too graphic for adults. But for kids, it's probably not a good idea. And that's an ongoing challenge because I feel strongly about an EMP attack on civilization being pretty much the end, especially as it's set up in these EMP books that I'm writing, both of them. It's just the end and things will get really, really bad. And it's a challenge to me to express how bad things will get and yet not make it just too graphic or too disgusting or violent, you know. There was also a scene, what chapter was it? I think it was 18 or 19 in the first book, when the protagonist is hiking on his way home and he's under a freeway overpass and he's able to listen to a couple of cannibals rationalizing, you know, killing humans for their meat. And the first couple of drafts of that chapter were just too graphic and too many details. And after a while, I just thought, no, this is a little over the top. So I kind of toned it down. But that's an ongoing challenge I have with these books. So Like I said, after this, I will have an announcement for a freebie. So let's get on with the reading.
Sneak preview of parts of chapters 7, 8, and 9 of EMP sequel book, copyright 2018, Cal Wilson. The next several days, David found himself operating a John Deere backhoe loader on the Brooklyn Bridge, protected by two New York police officers who also helped David refuel the backhoe or move the cars on the bridge. They made it clear that moving cars was not part of their job, but they figured that if they helped move the cars to the side, the bridge will be cleared that much sooner, and food could be brought in to feed everyone. It was a team effort. The EMP had hit at a time when the three-lane Brooklyn-bound side of the bridge was full of cars and trucks, and it looked like a solid parking lot, except for a break in the traffic closer to the Brooklyn side. David's job was to use the backhoe and heavy-duty nylon straps to lift and pivot each car or truck and put it into the outside lanes so that the innermost lane could be cleared and used to haul food from a military warehouse on Long Island into Manhattan. Sometimes, it was easier and faster to break into the car, put the car's transmission into neutral, and then use the backhoe to push the car to the outside lane. The work was slow, and David had a rotating group of onlookers on the bridge's center elevated pedestrian walkway. They occasionally paused to watch the work as they walked to Brooklyn. By noon of the third day, David had cleared about half the way across the mile-long bridge. With the open space on the second half of the bridge, David was close to having the entire inner lane of the bridge cleared so that food could be brought into Manhattan. "You hear that?" David asked his police escorts as they returned from the porta-potty that was under the on-ramp of the Manhattan side of the bridge. "No," one of them said. David gestured to the tall buildings behind him. Total silence. Manhattan, one of the loudest, most densely populated cities in the country, was almost deafening in its silence. A seagull flew nearby one of the large brick towers of the bridge. David could actually hear the bird flap its wings as it flew under some steel cables that supported the roadway. "Yeah, you're right. It's never been this quiet here," one of the police escorts responded. David restarted the backhoe and looked at the cars parked on the bridge ahead of him. The lot of the cars on the bridge was thick and empty of people, except for one car owner, a guy in jeans and a dirty t-shirt, looking about 20 years old, standing next to his car in the middle of the bridge. He appeared more and more anxious as David and the police officers got closer. One of the police escorts climbed up the backhoe and whispered something to David. "Don't look now, but I've been watching that kid hanging near his old Chevelle. He seems really protective of his beater car for some reason. He must have been sleeping in it." "Yeah, I've noticed him too. You guys should fan out. I think he has a gun." Chapter 8. David's friend, Andrew, called up to David loud enough to be heard above the noise of the backhoe engine. "The director's here with a few muckety-mucks." "Why are they here?" David put his engine in neutral and looked behind him at the important people arriving. He saw Director Voigt, dressed in his navy blue OEM windbreaker, with another man in a jacket and tie, and a tall African-American man in a police uniform that was covered with badges. Several aides orbited the three men as they walked closer. "Progress report?" "Listen, Andrew." David motioned for Andrew to come closer. "Your timing's not good. We're almost done clearing the cars from the bridge. But now we're nearby this beater car with a scumbag hanging around it. Kind of like the car's valuable or something." "Yeah, I saw him. You think he'll be a problem?" "I don't know. He seems pretty protective of that clunker." Andrew looked at the mostly carless Brooklyn end of the bridge so that he could analyze the man and his car without being obvious. "He's protecting something there, that's for sure." Pacing back and forth, "What, has he been sleeping in that car? The grid went down several days ago." "Could be. Well, it might be time to take a break and talk with the director and these guys anyway. The director wants to talk with you in front of these guys. One of them's the deputy mayor." David stepped down from his backhoe just as he noticed one of the police officers had started talking with the young man near his car. The policeman had his hands out in front, as if he was trying to calm the man down. The police officer suddenly dove behind a nearby car as the man pulled out a short rifle and shot at him. Several pedestrians on the elevated walkway of the bridge screamed and ran. The director and his entourage hid behind nearby cars. David and Andrew ducked behind a car. The gunman continued shooting at the policeman nearby. Then he shot at several pedestrians on the bridge's elevated walkway. David could see that the man was using a short black rifle. "It's a Tech 9," Andrew said to David. "Totally illegal, but standard for all the drug gangs. I hope you have your running shoes on. We should probably get the hell out of here." The gunman sprayed bullets towards everyone else on the bridge. A car windshield nearby David and Andrew shattered, and David heard the metal canopy of his backhoe get hit. The car he hid behind was shot in the grill and front tire. The car sunk as radiator fluid spilled onto the pavement. Several pedestrians trampled over others while the police officers fired back at the man. "We're totally outgunned," David said to Andrew, barely loud enough to be heard over the idling backhoe. The police officer, who had accompanied the deputy mayor, began shooting at the gunman with a larger handgun. The young man answered with more gunshots at the director, the officer, and the deputy mayor. He then sprayed a burst of bullets at the pedestrians on the elevated walkway, causing sparks to rain down wherever the bullets hit the bridge's cables. The pedestrians screamed in waves and they ran as they were targeted. "It's a standstill," Andrew said to David. David looked above the car he was hiding behind and saw the gunman had stopped shooting. The man reached for a magazine with more bullets in the open trunk of his car to replace the now empty magazine in his rifle. David crawled towards the still-running backhoe, staying low enough so as not to be seen. He reached up to the steering wheel of the backhoe, flicking up what on a car would be a turn signal. The backhoe lunged forward, forcing the nearest car into the gunman's car, then slammed the gunman's car into the gunman, pinning him between the car and the steel railing of the bridge. "Ah!" the man shrieked in pain as he dropped his gun and frantically tried to extract himself. He pried his leg free and sat on the bridge railing, then reached down for his gun. One of the policemen emerged from behind a nearby car and shot the gunman 3 times. The gunman spat out some blood as he fell off the bridge, desperately reaching back towards the railing as he fell. Seconds later, the man had fallen to his death. Relief overcame the nearby crowd. David turned off the backhoe as the police officers gathered in the open lane of the bridge. The higher-ranking police officer asked David's police escorts to help some pedestrians nearby who had been shot while the others would check out the car and see what the gunman was trying to protect. Director Voigt and the deputy mayor approached David. "You okay?" he asked David. "I'm fine. You?" I think we're okay." David noticed the deputy mayor had taken off his business jacket and held it in front of him, hoping that no one would notice that he had wet himself. "Look, David." The director started to introduce the deputy mayor to David, but stopped as he noticed Andrew was next to the gunman's car, trying to turn away a small crowd that had gathered around it. "Will everyone please stay away from this car?" the high-ranking policeman called out. "This is all evidence, and we'll have to process this crime scene." The people dispersed, replaced by the deputy mayor, Director Voigt, and their aides. David noticed that the trunk had inside it 2 overstuffed duffel bags. One of them was slightly open, showing wads of cash inside. The trunk also had several other short rifles, spare gun magazines, and some clear plastic baggies that contained white powder. "Yeah, I figured," the director said as he and the deputy mayor got closer to the car. "You know," the high-ranking police officer began, "if these were normal times, I'd say we impound the car, take the cash, guns, and drugs, and put it all into evidence. But we've got our hands full doing other things right now." He lowered his voice to the others huddled around him. "I say we just dump the drugs into the river, carry the cash and guns back to the station, and have an officer stand nearby the car until the bridge empties out and people lose interest." Director Voigt and the deputy mayor said, "Okay," together. David was surprised at how informal the incident was being taken by the man who looked like an assistant chief of police. throwing narcotics over the side of a bridge, and having police officers carry what looked like tens of thousands of dollars in cash back to the police station clearly showed that even cash was not as valuable now as it was before the EMP. The director turned to David. "David, we're moving you to the Manhattan Bridge, just north of here." He pointed to the bridge parallel and north of the Brooklyn Bridge. "The backhoe there is a lot smaller, and we think you can clear that bridge faster than the boys we have working there now." "All right. In the meantime, there's a refinery still on fire in Jersey, and the smoke is covering the western part of Manhattan. As I remember, that's where you and Beth live." "Yes, it is." "Why don't you stop by the office on your way home today and grab a couple of gas masks? If the smoke gets bad, this'll help you and Beth breathe a little easier." "All right, I think I will." The director turned to the man holding his jacket in front of him. "By the way, this is the deputy mayor, and this is David Vaughn. He's the guy I was telling you about, one of our top guys. Turned down an early retirement package to stay with us. He even came back from his vacation when the grid went down to help us out here." David and the deputy mayor shook hands. "Thanks, David," the director said, sounding in a hurry. "They're waiting for you at the Manhattan Bridge. You'll have a couple of cops helping you out there like you did here. We hope to have both of these bridges cleared by tonight, so we can start the food shipments in later tonight or tomorrow. We got some food stations ready and waiting." David took the hint that he was supposed to leave as soon as possible and work at the Manhattan Bridge. As he walked towards the city, David noticed the stream of pedestrians leaving the city by walking over the central walkway of the Brooklyn Bridge. He noticed that the people did not necessarily look dirty or hungry, but he could tell by their facial expressions that they were nervous. He clearly noticed a lack of hope in the faces of these people. He also noticed that, as with any given assembly of New Yorkers, there was a lot of ethnic diversity. One group of Puerto Ricans was followed by a Vietnamese family carrying a loudly crying infant and several blue and white striped nylon bags. They were followed by a couple of fair-skinned college students pushing small black nylon suitcases on wheels. It occurred to David that this was kind of like a wave of immigrants, similar to what New York had had in the 1800s, except this was a wave of people leaving. It was almost as if the crowds of people knew that the Statue of Liberty, with its inscription that welcomed huddled masses yearning to be free, had been smashed. All these masses were not necessarily yearning to be free, but rather yearning to survive. And leaving New York was part of their survival plans. Among those walking out of the city was a college-age man wearing workout clothes and jogging shoes, running at a measured pace across the bridge. On any given day, the elevated walkway of the bridge was crowded with many people jogging across, but a few days after the grid collapsed, the joggers seemed out of place. David saw a young, fair-skinned couple quickly step to the side of the walkway and check to see if their toddler needed his diaper changed. The mother checked inside a small carrying case. Walking behind the couple was a Middle Eastern man, carrying a long, narrow backpack and wearing a black and white scarf that covered part of his face. As with many of the pedestrians, the man looked nervous. He also appeared to be sweating, had thinning hair, and was pressing Kleenex to a bleeding nose. He glared at a man walking several dogs nearby, who in turn was followed by a dark-skinned Caribbean family. As David turned north onto South Street and walked towards the Manhattan Bridge, his thoughts turned to the director and what seemed to be the director's resigned attitude. David had only spent a few seconds on the bridge conversing with him, but in that short time, he got the impression that the director was disappointed about something, almost resigned. The director's upbeat approach to this crisis that David saw a few days earlier seemed to have vanished and was replaced by a sense of defeat. "I wonder if he has gotten news of how widespread this situation is. Maybe this is more than a regional thing after all." David walked next to a stalled city bus, and then it hit him. That guy on the bridge with the backpack. Was the man's hair loss and bloody nose caused by what he was carrying in the backpack? It looked like the man might have had radiation sickness. David stopped walking and looked at the buildings on the other side of the street. He sensed that something was gravely wrong. Suddenly, a huge flash enveloped the area, and in an instant, David could see the outline of the bus he stood next to on the buildings across the street, surrounded by the brightest white light he had ever seen. A deafening boom echoed from the buildings nearby, and a shockwave from behind him knocked David and the nearby bus over onto the street. He heard a combination of crashes and glass breaking. David instinctively closed his eyes and covered his ears as shards of broken glass landed on him and the street. Then, as quickly as he had been knocked to the pavement, David felt a tug towards the now capsized bus by a smaller reverse shockwave. The bits of broken glass on the road ripped through his jeans and cut his legs and arms as he was sucked back in the direction of the original blast. Chapter 9. David lifted his head from the pavement. While he heard a steady ringing in his ears, he could also hear groaning from people on the ground all around him. On the other side of the bus, David could see a bright, mushroom-shaped plume of smoke heading skyward above the East River. Grayish-brown smoke continually enveloped a white fireball from top to bottom as it climbed higher into the sky. He stood up and carefully brushed himself off and saw that the glass fragments had left several cuts in his legs and arms. He took a few steps behind the bus and towards the river, then looked at what was left of the Brooklyn Bridge. The roadway that had spanned the area between the two towers was now gone. The tops of both of the bridge towers had been sheared off, changing what had earlier been an M-shaped design of each tower into what looked like three aimless brick structures pointed skyward, about half the height as before the blast. A 50-yard chunk of the roadway still hung by one side of the cables to the tower on the Brooklyn side of the bridge. David heard the muffled trumpet sound of steel twisting and pulling to its breaking point, then saw the cables snap and the remaining roadway splash into the river. All that was left of the roadway that used to unite Manhattan and Brooklyn was the pair of on-ramps that joined the two towers on either side, and strands of rebar and lifeless cables hanging down. Still in a daze, David walked closer to the bridge on-ramp and heard a mix of his ears ringing and groans from people lying on the ground around him. Several cars had been tossed onto South Street and FDR Drive from the bridge, forming a small pile. Smoke trailed up from a fire that had begun in one of the cars. Under the on-ramp of the bridge, David saw the aqua-colored plastic porta-potty that he had used many times in the past few days, resting on its side. Someone inside was trying to push the door up. It was Director Voigt, who rolled out and fell onto the pavement. He was partially covered in sewage. David walked to the director, who looked up and smiled. "Thank God you made it," he said, only slightly louder than a whisper. David helped the director onto his feet, and the two of them slowly walked to a nearby bench. They sat down, buried their faces in their hands, and tried to collect their thoughts. The mushroom cloud ascended higher into the sky above Brooklyn, getting blown towards the Atlantic Ocean. David cleared his throat. "I walked right by him," he said to the director. "Who?" "The guy who carried the bomb onto the bridge. It was in his backpack. He had radiation sickness. I just know it was him." The director shook his head in disgust. "This wouldn't have happened before the grid went down. We have radiation sensors all around." He cleared his throat and continued. "In fact, we have all sorts of sensors here, in the subways too. Of course, they all need power to work. Maybe the terrorists knew that. This city has a lot of sleeper cells." "Well, yeah, but this was new. They must have hiked that nuke in from somewhere. Looks like a couple kilotons worth."
And there you have it. That's the reading of part of Chapter 7, all of Chapter 8, and part of Chapter 9 of the sequel to my first EMP book, which was entitled EMP, The End of the Grid as We Know It. And here's my announcement. June 30th through July 4th, 2018, you will be able to get the first book, like I said, which is entitled EMP, The End of the Grid as We Know It, you'll be able to get that book, the ebook version, for free on Amazon. So if you have a Kindle device during those days, you should be able to go onto Amazon and get that book downloaded onto your Kindle for free. And let me tell you what I do. I have a Kindle app on my iPhone. And even if you don't have a Kindle device, the app works fine. So you can just sign up and get that app on your smartphone, and you can download that book for free onto your smartphone or iPhone. I hope you enjoyed the preview. I'm just trying to get people to read book one in anticipation for the release of book two, which will come pretty soon. Like I said, I'm not charging anything for this. And if you are so inclined, I would appreciate a review of book one. And also, you're able to follow me on Amazon. You can follow author Cal Wilson on Amazon. That way, when the sequel book comes out, you will be notified of when that book comes out. Again, I think it's going to be later on in the summer or in the fall. There's not a date certain yet, but I would encourage you to follow me as author Cal Wilson on Amazon. And again, I'd appreciate any reviews. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the sneak preview of my EMP sequel book. And I hear the music. That means our time is up. Thank you for joining me. God bless.